Welcome to the Dealmaker Uncut podcast, where we speak to some of the UK's most exciting entrepreneurs and hear their investment journeys. We'll discuss the challenges, successes, and lessons they've learned along the way with expert deals commentary from Jonathan Boyers, Head of Alvarez & Marcel Corporate Finance, and me, Chris Maguire, Executive Editor at Business Cloud. Welcome everyone to the latest episode of the Dealmaker Uncut podcast powered by Alvarez & Marcel. My name is Chris Maguire and I'm the Executive Editor of Business Cloud. We're in London today and I'm joined by multiple award-winning dealmaker himself, Jonathan Boyers. Jonathan's been involved in deals totaling billions of pounds during his long and illustrious career, and he's a Managing Director and Head of Alvarez & Marcel's Corporate Finance Practice here in the UK. Welcome, Jonathan.
Hi, Chris.
And I'm looking forward to today. I'm looking forward to today's guest as well, because this gets really inside the deal and our guest today is a real character. In the first part of the show, we're going to be interviewing our special guest. After that, we'll be taking a short break, and in part two, Jonathan will be leaning on his 38-year career in corporate finance to answer listener and viewer questions. So, Jonathan, put our listeners and viewers out of their misery. Who are we speaking to today?
Thanks, Chris. Well, today we're speaking to Mark Sweeney, who is the CEO of a Welsh technology firm, De Novo Solutions. So Mark's a serial entrepreneur, won lots of awards as a founder, been involved in several startups, and one of his businesses, Certus Solutions, was sold to Accenture. And I'm great, looking forward to hearing the story. So welcome, Mark.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me.
I always think, Mark, when we do that bit, who are we speaking to today? It reminds me of Rainbow, if you're of an age. You know, which window are you looking through today, Jonathan? So, okay, so...
Are you saying I'm Bungle?
No, I'm not saying you're Bungle. I'm not saying you're George either.
Does that make me zippy?
Absolutely. So one for the kids, that joke. Mark, I'm going to take you back to the beginning as well. Although you're proudly based in Wales, you haven't lost your Bexley Heath accent. I think I'm right in saying as well that had you not gone down a road into computers, your big dream was to be a drummer in a rock band. Is that right?
Absolutely, absolutely. But my mother and father had other ideas for that.
You still got the drum set, though, haven't you?
I still got the drum set, and I still dabble and play. So.
Yeah, it's not too late. You know, it's not too late for you. Your first job was printing bank statements at Lloyds Bank. But then I think serendipity played a part when you were asked to oversee a project many years after that, incidentally, when you were asked to oversee a project for the prison service in Wales, and that led you to set up Certus Solutions. So just explain that bit of your life.
Yeah, I left school. To be honest, I'm not the A-level student. I kind of bunked off on my A-levels and had enough of it, but I found myself in the world of, in the 80s, what we call data processing department, which is the fledgling beginnings of the IT industry back then, working on the technology they put, IBM technology, they put man on the moon in the 1960s, so the big mainframes. So that's where I started. But you start at the bottom, in the basement, input-output operator, I think was my grand title. So the input was put in the tapes, and one for the kids, Joe 90, those big tapes on tape machines, and the output was printing people's bank statements. So that's where I started from there. But you know, as anything, I got myself out of the print room and started a career in what became information technology. So went through operations, programming, was a DBA, and then really I suppose what I became was, because it was quite fledgling back in the 90s, and what I identified myself was basically one of the first professional technology project managers. I was a project manager and implementing systems, and then ERP came around in the mid to late 90s, and I got involved in that. So that was where it all started from, and moving through.
So you set up Certus Solutions in 2007.
Yeah.
And it might just be interesting to hear, you know, how you went about doing that, what prompted you to do it, and then how that business developed.
Yeah, I think it goes back to when I was like, I'd done all the jobs in IT and going up for project management, and then I got involved ultimately in sales, business development, and I got to work for an Australian company run by an entrepreneur, and I got to spend 5 years really working very closely with him as part of as a technical consultant to him. But I got to really see how business operated and was undertaken. And that company was acquired, a bit of a reverse takeover to get itself onto the stock market. And I went through that process. But at the end of it, I felt I kind of wanted to try it myself in some way. Obviously not as grandiose as that business ended up being, but I just wanted to get into it because I had been around it so much now. And the first business I got involved in failed, basically, completely. And to be honest, I don't talk about it that much because I got sacked from it. So that's a whole story. But then I went back to being contract project management, and I found myself by serendipity through people I knew. The prison service then had a program that wasn't going so well, but it was just an ERP system, an Oracle one, and that's how I got into it. And as a contractor, I started as Certus was myself, and then myself and some people that I knew around me that helped me create deliver the program, and that's how it all started. That was the initial genesis of it. And to be honest, it was just based out of an idea that we were doing these programs in the public sector, and it was the first time I'd done a public sector project, and I just felt the standard suppliers that were delivering to the public sector, they just weren't that very good. They were very large and very big. And I thought, well, we can do this better than them. And it was nothing more complicated than, well, we can do this job better than you. And that was the starting point of it.
And so you grew that business. It got to around about 10 million in turnover.
Yeah.
And then eventually Accenture came along and you sold it to them.
Yeah.
Do you want to talk? Can you talk about how that came about?
Yeah.
And how that felt?
So the first iteration of Certus was, and a lot of people start off as, well, back then, probably not so much now, but you start off as a contractor and then you have so many people around you to deliver projects. And one of the people that I met was my long-term business partner, Tim Warner. And he was a solution architect, where I was more of a project manager. And by serendipity, we just happened to know some very senior people in Oracle through the work we were doing. And Oracle were working on a project called Fusion, which became cloud. And they basically invited us because what they wanted to do was talk to people that actually knew how to implement the systems. And they didn't want to build this Oracle applications, which basically digitalize, transform HR, payroll, finance, business operations. They basically didn't want to build something in an ivory tower that couldn't be implemented. So they would show us what they built and we would say, that's great, or that's not so great because we can't implement that. And that's where it became. So we became the pioneers of Oracle Cloud in the UK. And that was the real differentiator for Certus. We really created the market. We redefined how cloud would be implemented, very different to doing on-premise systems that we had done for the 20 years previously. And we literally wrote the book of how to do it. And that was the big differentiator. But we went further than that. We understood that most businesses, regardless of industry, 80% of what they do is the same for the back office. It's the 20% that makes them different. So what we went about doing was creating a blueprint, and we created a blueprint for government operations way back in 2015. And that led us to winning the likes of the Office for National Statistics, the Treasury, and ultimately, we won the Home Office, and we won that with Accenture.
And ultimately, Accenture came along and acquired the business. How did that happen?
Where we were was, we were working with Accenture on winning the Home Office implementation for Oracle Cloud. They called it the Metis program. But all our eggs wasn't in one basket. It was obviously working right across the public sector, but we also had quite a decent-sized private sector business that was developing. We had the likes of Willis Towers Watson, DHL, supply chain and Skanska Sweden. And some of those clients were also Accenture obviously had touch points with, and we were growing, and that's where the conversation began about potentially acquiring us.
So it just evolved from a business, from a trading relationship?
Yeah, effectively. And I suppose, you know, when you're working together, from their perspective, you try before you buy. Yeah. from that perspective, and it moved forward. But the advantage they had was that Certus was the first mover advantage. You know, it was the brand in the UK for Oracle implementation, so it was of this type.
And there was an earnout for 3 years. So did you stay for 3 years and work with them?
I stayed really for a year with them, right. And then I was still obviously locked under legal obligations with them. But then COVID hit as well, so it was I sat COVID out on the sidelines for a couple of years. And it was from that, I suppose, to a degree of inactivity, shall we say, that actually I felt I was still young enough and had something to offer, and I wanted to come back and do things again. And I think things that we wanted to do through the acquisition, unfortunately, didn't work out and we couldn't do them. And we still felt there was opportunity and there were still things we wanted to do. So a lot about de novo was the driver for it, to a degree, was unfinished business. We had a lot of things that we wanted to do that
I'm going to ask you about the background to that business. Yeah. If I may, was the deal size 15 million, was that right?
For Certus, yeah.
Yeah. There's something you spoke about, because after you left Certus, you did a bit of angel investing.
Yeah.
And we spoke off air, yeah. And you said it didn't go particularly well. And actually, you made two conclusions. One was actually that you were the best return on investment, so why wouldn't you put your money on you? And the second was that you look for the eye of the tiger in the companies you invest in or the people you found business with, which I understand, but just explain what you mean by that.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, the selling to Certus was financially beneficial. And this is quite a well-trodden path, I think, for entrepreneurs, where they look then to reinvest, and you are looking also to reinvest in the next generation of things, but you do want a return on it. You're not giving away money for free of it. And you know, obviously you start to get approached a lot from what you've done, and would you look at this business, would you look at this idea? And I started doing it, to be honest. I suppose it's like a lot of things. You start looking at investments. It's probably not my bag. It's not something that I was very good at doing. Well, I began to learn from it very well. The things I have learned is if I do invest in something, I tend to invest in something I actually understand and I know about in the sector. As soon as I start moving outside my sphere of knowledge, that's when it tends to go horribly, horribly wrong. But
you didn't invest in like avocado farms?
But what I found was over time was that some of the things that I've invested in that I did think was good ideas and did have good, you know, I felt had good potential and good traction, but those businesses over time didn't make it. And I found, you know, a couple of times that the entrepreneurs, they gave up. And so much of it is that you have to have so much, I think, determination, grit and tenacity about you. I mean, Certus, we nearly went bankrupt twice doing it. And that was because we were so far ahead of the market in cloud. Remember, this is like 2010. We were 2 years ahead of the market. We never really got traction to the back end of 2012. That's a long time not to be earning proper money, you know, and being able to survive that. But you've got to find a way through it. And I think all about entrepreneurship and running a business is part of the challenge is you have to find the way. And it's the rocky moment, isn't it? You know, life will beat you down. It will. I don't know why at times we do this, but, you know, the only person that's going to pick you up off the floor is you. It's not someone else, it's you, and you've got to have that about you. And when I looked at that, and I look at people, and I look at the capital I do have available, to be honest, the best return's in me. So I kind of hold back these days from doing it, and I rather invest in me, because I can control myself, I know myself, I know, you know, the drive still there to do it, and it's just the way I've learned. And okay, if I do things, okay, not everything I do works out, but I can accept that. So it's a mentality thing, and I do look. I think a lot of early stage investing is you're really looking into the people, because you're saying, when this really gets tough, and it will, are you going to stick it out? Are you really, really going to stick it and ride it out? Because it does, and that's the way it is. So it's just something I've learned and I've come across.
So you set up Denovo Solutions, which is another similar business, digital transformation, but with a technology background. Do you want to just talk about where that business is up to?
Well, as I said, when we came back, and it's just been going 5 years, so I suppose it's still a young business. It's literally just finishing its fifth year. But to give you some idea, it's 2.5 times the size of Certus now, so it's a lot bigger. You know, we describe it as a technology company because it is. It's not just a professional services firm consultancy. It's far more than that. It's got product. We IPR. We do a lot of using our IP to productize it. So we look to create passive income streams, and we do that by creating digital blueprints for given industries. So you try and get a SaaS model approach going. We have a managed services, so we look to reinvent managed services using the technology that's now available. So much about managed services falls apart because suppliers aren't transparent with the client, and the client's saying, I'm paying you this money, where's it actually going? So we've addressed that. So we can provide complete transparency of services, but that creates recurring revenue streams. Everybody likes a recurring revenue stream from there. And then, of course, we do have the professional services element of the consultancy and the implementation. And then the last thing we're doing, or the newest thing, is now people are coming to us, and I think it's a nature of where businesses are today that there is quite a lot of people, businesses out there, organisations, that actually can't digitally transform their back office. They just can't do it. It's not that they want to do it, and it's not that they've found the capital to do it. They just physically can't do it. And then we said, right, well, if we go back to an old concept of business process outsourcing, but could we now recreate that model using things like AI, using the technology and the blueprints we created and the managed services, and create a new service proposition, and we'll run the systems for you. And therefore, by doing that, we digitally transform you. So it's just a different way of looking at it. So it's quite multifaceted, really.
You're based in Wales.
Yeah.
But that's down to your wife, Natalie, isn't it?
A lot of it's down to my wife, Natalie. But that program, the first program with Certus, was the prison service, and Newport, which is probably not on everybody's place to visit, is probably the centre of cloud, because Newport was where we built one of the first government shared service centres for the prison service 20 years ago. So that's what took me to Wales. And the ONS, which was the first implementation Certus did of Oracle Cloud, is literally 1,000 metres around the corner from the shared services.
When you sold Certus and you're kicking your heels for the legal restrictions, you said to your missus, you said, I think about setting up a business. I think she was desperate to get you out of the house.
Yeah.
And she said yes, on one condition, you move back to Wales.
Yeah.
And then, best decision you ever made.
Absolutely. I think the conversation went more like, you need to get a job. You need to do something. And I said, who the hell is going to employ me? Can I do another business? So Denovo is my fourth business. So four I've been involved in, three I've founded and taken through. And Denovo is definitely, you know, potential still has more potential than the others, all the others combined. But it was that she wanted to go back for family reasons. But I had been looking for Wales for 20 years, And I could understand the desire, the ambition of the Welsh government needing to move the economy from tourism, agriculture, heavy industry, obviously Tata Steel, last steel as we know it, was closed last year. Yeah. And they wanted to move it into the modern world, effectively, you know, high-tech digital, you know, digital fintech businesses, the InsurTech, Admiral, and all its spin-offs come from Cardiff, great success stories. But they wanted to move the economy into that direction, and that takes like 20 years to do, you know, if you can do it at all. But to be fair, they wanted to start the journey, and a third of the people that were in CERTAS were from Wales because of our relationship with Wales. So we could see there was an untapped talent pool, and of course Brexit's never really helped any of us in the talent side. So the attitude, my attitude has always been, well, we can sit and moan about it forever, or we have to find ways of getting the next generation into technology, and we've got to build that skill and capability up. And the Welsh government has the most amazing graduate apprenticeship program, and it's so topical right now with student loans. Mm. Doesn't happen in Wales if you go into tech, because you come and be an employee with a sponsor. They're employed by us, the apprentices. And we start them off at the bottom, the minimum wage, which is, I would say, is not so minimum these days. You know, a person probably costs us 28,000 just to employ them if you're right at the bottom, you know. So it's a big investment for a size of business like us.
Do you remember what your first salary was?
My first salary? Yeah. I was very well paid. My basic was about $6,500, and I had shift allowance, which took me to $11,000 in 1987. So that's exceptional.
Mine was $5,886 a year, less than $6,000 a year. I bet you were one of you.
Mine was six, but the week before I joined, it went up to $6,500.
Yeah. So this is honestly, I think this podcast is going to bring back memories.
Yeah.
So you've grown Denovo Solutions now to 12 million of turnover, and you're employing 140 people across Wales, India, and across the UK. So what's the plan now for that business?
I mean, there's incredible amounts of growth still left in it. We can see a path to £50 million worth of revenue a year, and a lot of that is, though, not just increasing the headcount, it's actually leveraging the new technology like AI through these new service propositions like the BPO payroll services. So, as I said, 20 years ago, we needed a big building with 500 people in it, but we didn't have that kind of technology available. Today, we need a smaller building. I don't really want 500 people in it, but 20 people, but we can use all the technology to create, I suppose, digital experiences, digital conversations before you need the expertise to come in and provide still brilliant customer service. We don't want to go into the, BT call centres, press 1, 2 and 3 and find yourself in wherever. We want to remove that kind of experience. So I think the technology that's available today has incredible amounts of, you know, opportunity for us all to being able to leverage it in some way to create new service propositions.
Does that mean AI? Oh.
Yeah, just AI, but also adaptive analytics. You know, it's understanding what's actually going on inside a business and then acting on it. You've still got to do that. I suppose if you take it to extreme, you can understand what's going on inside a business and then you can get the AI to act on it. But I think there's still a role for human intervention here. I don't think you can take the human experience out of it altogether. But I think by using the people that we've got and harnessing those technologies, that creates new service propositions and creates revenue streams and value, you know, moving forward. So it's a modern take, maybe on an old recipe, if you want to look at it that way.
You're completely bootstrapped. That's the amazing thing. You've mentioned the four businesses you've been involved in.
Yeah.
And yeah, I'm a tech journalist. I'm reporting all the time on businesses that have raised millions of quid. You've not raised any. And I bet that's not because you're short of offers.
No, we're lucky, as I said, with CERTAS. That was so pioneering. That was so risky at the top of the risk profile, because we just talk about cloud, it just exists today. It didn't back then. Everybody was very apprehensive about it, you know, even looking at it. So, you know, we know what it's like to be within 6 hours of having to close a business down. You do not want to be in that place. But obviously, we did a successful financial exit, so we could fund and over ourselves, which we did. And I do believe, though, generally, again, part of the journey is you have to find a way of funding your ideas. I don't believe just going out raising loads of money is naturally the answer. There is a point in time you need to do that, depending on where you want to go, but that's not necessarily the first default position. And I see too many people, personally, the first thing they do is they want to go out and raise £1 million. And then they'll be back next year wanting to raise another £1 million. It's like, it's not the way to do it. I think you've got to, you know, find, part of it is finding the way, and finding the way of how you can use capital. I mean, we grow de novo, a lot of it. Perhaps we're in a more privileged position now. You can say it's a privileged position. I think we've earned our stripes of it. We do use debt capital. So why should we give away equity? We use the debt capital. So we can leverage that. And we do, because of our track record, we have people, the banks will back us. So we're in a more fortunate position. But it doesn't mean that you can't, it doesn't excuse you from being highly disciplined. You know, cash is king every day. And you know, you live and die by those things. So
that's key. So you're 57 now. What's the end game?
Well, I still feel I'm really, I've had a lease of life. I think that's probably working with young people, that is. I don't understand them, but they do make me laugh at times. But I feel really good. I don't want to be in a situation where I'm sitting back at home again. You know, that wasn't good for 2 years. Yeah. And I put a lot of weight on as well. So
I can identify with that.
Yeah, so for me, there's a lot of fire in my belly. The eye of the tiger's still there. There's lots of things I still want to do. I think the way AI is, and the new technology, because is developing, is just creating more opportunities, really, that can be harnessed. So I think that's really good. And I think, you know, a key part of what we've done is, what we're doing with De Novo is we're trying to build a positive legacy down in Wales, because we can get more people into work down there with highly skilled jobs. And we feel that's something that's worth doing. And yeah, we'll make money, it's fine. But there's a lot of things we can do, you know, to create wealth in lots of different ways, not necessarily financial, by giving opportunities to other people that may not necessarily would have had those kind of opportunities. So for us, there's lots to do. So
you said it. When you started Certus, you started it up with a view that you knew you were going to sell it.
Yeah.
So it was packaged in a way that when somebody wanted to buy it, it was ready.
Yeah.
De novo, is that the same?
I think what's driving it is different. It's just different perspective from it. Don't get me wrong, if somebody walked in and with a very large number on the table, I think we would all look at it and go, well, perhaps. But we don't have that purpose. With Certus was designed from the outset to be sold. It was specifically designed, and it was designed because we knew the large tech companies, the large systems integrators, they don't actually invest in new skills and new technology. They don't do it. That's not saying they don't have good people. They have plenty of good people. But corporately, they're constrained. So they become very predictable in what they do. So, I mean, when I compete against them, I could write their bids for them because I know exactly what they're going to do. I know exactly how they're going to price it because that's how those organisations work. And that creates opportunity. So predictability creates opportunity. That's a big phrase for us. And we know exactly how they're going to pitch it. And we know, therefore, we know how to compete against them from that perspective. So we knew that when we was building Certus, in 5-6 years' time, they won't spend 5-6 years trying to build what we did. Mm. They won't go through the pain, you know, all the late nights, the we haven't got any money and all the woes. They don't do that. But suddenly they have FOMO, fear of missing out. And the quickest way to deal with it is buy someone. and there you are, all prepackaged. And that's actually, again, that's a pretty tried business model, really. So that's Certus. You could say Accenture acquired it, or someone else was going to acquire it. I would say that we sold it because it was designed to be sold. De Novo, though he has very similar characteristics, that isn't really the end game of us. It's evolved itself on this journey that we've been on, and we don't think really we want to end back up where we were the last time. So for us, and because we can grow it, there's still the challenge of growing it. So much of this is not competing with others, it's competing with yourselves. Can we do this? Can we get it to that point? And that's what drives us, really. So I think there's a lot more to go to it yet. That's not to say that we may not look at bringing in external capital or something to accelerate the growth, but the difference is we want to be in control of it.
What's lovely, just talking to you, we're going to finish there for part one. It's just when you talk about De Novo, your eyes light up, you love it, you know, and that's what's great, you know. You're not going through the motions, far from it. So, Mark, massive thanks for coming in today and for sharing your story with the Dealmaker Uncut. That's all for part one. Well, welcome back to the second half of the Dealmaker Uncut podcast. We've interviewed Mark Sweeney, CEO of De Novo Solutions, one of the most highly rated entrepreneurs, actually, in the UK, regularly figures in those sorts of lists. Jonathan, what did you think?
So obviously, the first business that he set up was cutting edge when at the time, and he built that up and sold it, and that was almost the focus of the business. But talking to him now, he's obviously really passionate about what he's doing for the apprentice scheme and to develop the business in Wales, and you know, we were talking outside the pod as well. He is really passionate about developing Wales. So, yeah, just a really interesting story.
Yeah, I think when we do the Dealmaker Uncut podcast, we think, what are the component parts that make the podcast interesting, hopefully, to our listeners and our viewers? And obviously, we're talking about deals, talking about investment raises, you know, talking about angel investment, talking about exits, whatever it might be. I think the interesting thing about Mark is that he gets approached every week with corporate finance people wanting to invest in his business, but he turns it all down. He knows what he wants, but at the age of 57, he feels like his best years are ahead of him, which is inspirational stuff as far as I'm concerned. The final part of the show is when I ask you, Jonathan, some questions where you lean into your 38 years' experience in corporate finance. And the first question is from a regular listener to the podcast, and it's a really good question, actually. She says, Jonathan, I listen to every episode of the Dealmaker Uncut podcast, so thank you to you. But where do you go to find buyers for the companies that you're acting on behalf of?
Well, I suppose every business has a different buyer. Obviously, the depends really what sector you're in. We have loads of people who are deeply involved in specific sectors, and normally when somebody comes in to talk to us about selling the business, one of the first things we do, we bring the sector team in and we look really carefully. And we normally know the most obvious buyers just because of our activities in the sector. You know, most of our sector guys will know the CEOs are the most likely buyers. But then also, you know, as A&M as an organisation is a $4.5 billion turnover global business. Half of that is in the US, and so very often where there's US trade buyers for a business in sectors, there's always somebody somewhere in the firm that will know the obvious buyers, or even some of the less obvious buyers. So each case is different, but obviously we do a whole load of research as well, but usually our sector guys know the buyers already.
Okay, next question is from another regular listener. They're looking to sell their business, and they've asked this question. I've been offered a 4x multiple for my business, but I don't think this is a true reflection of the value. How can I increase the multiple?
So ultimately, a business is worth what a buyer will pay for it. The theoretical valuation of a business is the present value of the future cash flows that it will generate. So people use apply a multiple to an earnings figure, really as an approximation to that net present value calculation, the amount of cash the business is going to generate. How do you make a multiple higher? Well, run a competitive process. The competitive tension drives higher values. But improving the quality of the business, the quality of the management team, improving the quality of earnings, contracted earnings is generally much more valuable than one-off earnings, and developing a business proposition in a sector where growth is likely. I mean, effectively, the more likely a business is to grow, the higher its value will be. So there's some simple ways really to improve the value of a business, but each sector has different prospects. Prepare thoroughly for a process and then run a competitive process.
Yeah, thank you very much. And final question, Jonathan. This comes from Chris McGuire, big fan of your work. Entrepreneur Paul Simkiss has just sold Rochdale-based Simkiss Group to United Infrastructure. I interviewed him and he said he did it because of Rachel Reeves's changes to inheritance tax and believes other SMEs will follow suit. I've been contacted by other SMEs who've already followed suit. Do you think, are you seeing a lot of this stuff, and do you think he's right?
Well, there are a number of private businesses now where if they've got significant individual shareholders, the changes to inheritance tax will mean that when they die, a significant inheritance tax bill will be payable. And often the only way that can be paid is by raising money in the business concerned. And if you've got two or three shareholders and one of them needs to fund an inheritance tax bill, you can end up having to pay out a lot of money, and often more money than the debt capacity of a business, for example. So quite a lot of entrepreneurs who are in their twilight years are starting to think they're going to have to sell the business to avoid the business being burdened with an inheritance tax bill. So it's very common at the moment.
Okay, thanks very much for those questions. Thanks very much to you, Jonathan, for answering them. That's all for this episode of the Dealmaker Uncut podcast with Alvarez and Marcel. Thank you to you, Jonathan.
Thanks, Chris.
Yeah, and don't forget to subscribe to the podcast, tell your friends and family, and follow us on social media. My name, as always, is Chris McGuire.